Bobbig.
All right, let's welcome Gabriel Scherer to our afternoon session. He works at INRIA and contributes for to OCaml. And today he is going to talk to us about object-oriented versus functional programming. So enjoy.
Thank you. Okay, thanks. Also, I deserve to Stefan Weh, who was my program committee member in charge of my talk, forced me to do my talk on time and so on, and gave useful feedback. So yes, I was already introduced. I work in a research team, so INRIA is a public research institute. The team is doing programming language theory and also proof theory, so the study of the structure of formal proofs. I'm a contributor to the OCaml implementation. I do a lot of work to make it easier for other people to contribute, so code reviews, refactoring, and so on. And I'm a member of the OCaml Software Foundation. And actually, Heavers talks this morning about open source and sustainability made me add a slide about that. Okay. So the OCaml Software Foundation is a non-profit that gets money from industry sponsors and try to use it to strengthen the OCaml community and also the Reason community. And there is also a Reason Association based in Vienna who is doing the same work as well for the Reason community. So some of the examples of the thing that one of either association supports financially. So if you are in a company that has money and want to use it to strengthen the OCaml and or Reason ecosystem, you should talk to us. Okay, so today I'm going to talk about a symmetry between OO, object-oriented, and functional programming styles. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a very simple thing that occurs in many typical problem domains that you could be implementing software in, where the data you have fits in several possible cases. For example, data is an address, and maybe some people provide a phone number, and some other provide an email address. Then you get to define operations on your domain, on the data you have. And often these operations are defined by case analysis. Okay, if you want to contact that person, it's going to behave differently depending on whether you need to contact them by phone or by email. In a typical functional programming style, what you would do, so the code in my talk is in OCaml, which is a language that the vast majority of you do not know, and this is good because everyone is on an equal footing here. So I'm going to explain the code and feel free to ask me at any point, ask a question at any point. So usually you will have a type with all the cases. So I took a very boring and academic example. The keynote also said that like data structures are useless these days. And this is a very boring data structure. It's a binary tree, okay? So it's a tree of A, and a tree of A, so when you read OCaml code, you should reverse list of A tree means a tree of A, like an int list means a list of ints. It's either a leaf, and then it contains some value of type A, or it's a node, and then it contains two trees, a left tree and a right tree. And so we have this type tree that describes all the cases of our domain. A tree is either a leaf or a node, one of the two. And then for each operation you want to define on trees, you define a function. So I have a count function that counts the number of leaves. So the number of leaves in a leaf is one, and the number of leaves in a tree that is a node is the number of leaves on the left plus the number of leaves on the right. So this function and pattern matching syntax is a way to define a function by case analysis. And then I can also define the height of a tree. And in this particular case, I decided that the leaf has height 0. So the height is the node height. And then a node, if you have a node, there is 1, which is the height of this node. And then you pick the highest of the left or the highest of tree, and you add the height of that. Okay. So, I mean, it doesn't really matter, but these are examples I needed for my talk. And so, for example, here is a way to write a node. The left subtree is a leaf that contains the data 1, the right subtree is a leaf of, that contains data 2, and if I count the number of leaves on my example tree, I get 2. Okay, so pretty simple program, pretty typical of the code you will see if you look at an F-sharp or Scala or Haskell, well, F-sharp or Haskell or Camel or reasoning program. Scala can go both ways. So the other way it could go is the typical object-oriented approach, which is say, objects have carries their operations with them, so let's define an interface with all the operations, the methods that we want on our for our problem domain. So this is object-oriented of Camel code, but people don't usually see that very often. Class type defines an interface, so an A tree is an object in this interface that satisfies this interface is an object with a method count and a method hey, and both returns an integer. So I can define an instance of this interface which is leaves. So a leaf, I can use pointers. A leaves it takes a value of type v of type a, and then it defines what it means to count a leaf. So counting a leaf, it has one leaf, and the node height of a leaf is zero. And I can define a node class. So node left right means that this class is defined. It takes two parameters when you want to create an object of this class. Okay, so left subtree and right subtree. And now I know how to count the number of leaves in such a node. I call the count method on the left subtree, and I add it to the count on the right subtree. And this sharp syntax is the method call syntax in the count. And the height is one plus the max of the left height and the right height. So same program, different organization. And I can define an example, same way. I have a new node. So new creates a new object of this class. I need to pass as many parameters as there are in the class declaration. So new leaf one, new leaf three. So it's not exactly the same example. I think I had two here. And I can call the count method, and I get two, and everything works. So pretty typical object-oriented organization. And the point is that the two, they look like different, but also similar in some ways, right? Of course, it's the same code, but it looks different. So what exactly do we mean? Well, one way to make this precise is to say, well, there is a symmetry, some people say duality, between the two approaches. And the way we describe it in abstract, I'm like programming language researchers would say, oh, the object-oriented organization is a product of functions. Product, we mean a pair, a tuple of functions. So an object is kind of like a tuple or a record of functions. So product is when you have data that is made of a this and a that. And the function organization is functions, so a bunch of functions over sums. Sums describe data where you have something or something else. Okay. So they are dual in certain sense. So here is an example of what we may mean. Consider an abstract example where you have two cases in your data, case one and case two, and then you want to define two operations and the result type of this operation. The first one is result one, and the second is R2. And so here, in this, this would be the typical object-oriented representation. To implement this, I will provide two classes, okay? The first class is for the first case, C1, and it bundles the two operations, the one that returns R1 and the one that returns an R2, so these would be the methods that you can call to get this R1 and this R2. And the second class is for the second case, C2, so you give me the data of C2, and I give you an object that I can answer the same interface, returns R1 if you call the first method, or the R2 if you call the second method. And the functional programming organization looks more like that. It's like, my code is two functions, okay? And the first one is the function that computes the result of the operation R1, and the input it takes is either a C1 or a C2. And the same thing for the second function, okay? So I hope you can see how it matches in an abstract way with the code that I had, for example, on this slide. So this would be the product, this would be C1, and R1 would be the count, the result of the count, and R2 the result of height. So in this case, both are integers. And here, the count function would be taking a C1 plus C2. C1 would be leaf, C2 would be node, and the result in both cases. So here, the result is an R1 which is an integer in this case. Okay, and the point is that if you think of it in these abstract terms, so if you are someone that knows about type theory, you can think of the product here as the type theory product and the sum as the type theory sum. If you know about sets, like in mathematics, you can think of these as sets, Cartesian product, and disjoint union. If you know none of these things, it doesn't really matter. You can just listen to the talk informally and it's fine. And the point is, these two representations are equivalent. You can show that they are equivalent by using two reasoning rules which are very simple. The first is that, okay, if you have a function that takes an A and returns a B and a C, it's kind of the same as having two functions, one that returns the A and the one that returns the C, okay? And the other rule, which is maybe a bit weirder for people sometimes, is that if you have a function that takes an A or a B and returns a C, well, that's the same as knowing how to get a C from A and knowing how to get a C from B. And if you use these two rules, you can go from the first representation, use the first rule, and then you will get four things, okay, C1 to R1, C1 to R2, C2 to R1, C2 to R2, and then you can use the second rule in reverse to group among the four things, the two that return the R1, and you will get something that is exactly like that, and the two that return an R2, and you get something that is like that. So it's exactly the right height for the presentation. So you can use these rules to prove that the two representations are equivalent, which means that something we knew intuitively, that the information we gave in the two programs is the same. Okay, there is no duplication in one, there is no better representation. They are just two sides of the same coin. They contain the same information, they just organize differently. Which sounds nice because it's when people like to argue over the internet about which style is better, you can say, well, actually they are the same modulo this symmetry or this duality, and so any advantage that the one has probably corresponds to an advantage that the other has in a different way, and so you can try to get people to stop arguing. Okay? It doesn't work that way, but you can try. So at this point we say, okay, so the two are actually sort of the same, so this is all well and good. But there is a bit more we can say about this, which is interesting. Does anyone have a question by now? No? No? Yes?
I don't know if you may be getting to that, but with the overall approach, you can have subtyping. You can start writing functions that only work for nodes, for example. And that's not possible unless you have dependent types.
So actually, I'm not going to talk about this one. I'm going to talk about other related topics, but probably not this one. Sorry. But I would say, okay, if you have some typing in the OO approach, it means that if you look through the symmetry, there is also something nice that you can have on the functional side, and it's your job to figure it out, what it is. But it is also nice, because nice becomes nice. So I was going to talk about something a bit different, possibly slightly related, which is extension. Okay, when you have a program in one of these styles, then you want to extend your program, what happens? So this is just a quick recap of the two kind of paradigmatic examples. We had the first of the functional style, a counter operation defined on the two cases, and the second being a class that handles two operations on the same case. And then, well, some pretty typical things you could want to do if your problem domain map this nice decomposition into cases and operation, which in practice is always more complicated, but it applies in a lot of situations, is to, well, maybe I need to add a new case, or I need to add a new operation, okay? So if you want to add a new case, so in this silly example, it would be node 3 constructor that takes, instead of two children, three subtrees, okay? If you have a functional style for your representation, it's very easy, right? You extend your type with a new case, and then the compiler will yell at you saying, oh, all these functions do not match on all possible inputs, so you need to extend them, so you update each function in turn, and you get a final program that knows how to compute the count and the height of the node free case, and the compiler is not going to let you away until you do that. If you are in the object-oriented programming world, you just add a new class for node 3 that defines count and head. If now you want to add a new operation, in the functional world, you just add a new function to the end of your module or some other module. In the OO world, you extend the interface, and then the compiler is going to help yell at you by saying, oh, you forgot to implement this method of the interface in all these places, and you have to update them, and in the end it stops yelling and you are happy because your code implements the new operation. Okay, so you may see that there is a sort of symmetry in the two scenarios, which is, I mean, of course, it's sort of the point of this talk. So people have been looking at that and trying to draw a conclusion about, you know, I was saying you cannot say which is better, but now maybe we can say that one of these things is better than the other. Okay? So usually what people take away is, in the functional programming style, it's easy to add a new operation, whereas in the object-oriented style, it's easy to add a new case. Why do we say that? Because usually we like it when we can evolve the program by just adding stuff at the end. Why is that? Because sometimes you are not the only person writing the code, you are actually using a library written by someone else, and you cannot actually get, or maybe you don't yet have edit rights on their copy of the software. So if you can, as a client, add stuff on your side and not have to modify the library instead of forking it and then rendering it, that sounds good for you. So it's kind of sort of a result of the way we evolve code these days. We prefer to reuse other people's code without modifying it and just doing append-only stuff on our side. So then we say, okay, FP styles make adding new operations easy, and O styles make making new cases easy. And then some people, you know, I mentioned programming language research. What researchers like to do is to find hard problems, convince themselves that they are really very important problems to solve, and then work hard at trying to solve them. So people were saying, okay, we have these two qualities, and then could we have both qualities at the same time? So starting from the late 90s, there was a research program called the extensibility problem or the expression problem that was like, can we make both sort of additions, both adding cases and adding operation, easy, simultaneously? And actually what we mean here is that, okay, it should be easy to add a new operation without modifying the code, to add a new case without modifying the code, and also we want to keep the property that if we forget to implement a case in an operation, the compiler yells at us. Okay, because otherwise it's sort of easy to do. If you are, for example, a Julia programmer, like you would do these kind of things easily, but then nothing tells you whether you forget something in some place, and it's sort of bad. And there have been solutions proposed in the research literature in the 90s, in the 2000s, some even in the 2010s. So like the last decade or not, whether you consider that 2020 is a new decade or is the last year of the previous decade. And the solutions, I'm not going to talk about them in this talk. Why? Well, because it would be too long, and because the proposed designs are, in my experience, rarely used in practice. Why is that? Because they are more complex than any of the two designs I've proposed. Okay, I've shown you that everyone is using nowadays. So it's like, they are nice, they have good theoretical properties, but every time you design a new language feature to make something more powerful, not every time, but sometimes, well, sometimes you are just lucky and you end up in a very nice place and everything is better than before, but some other times, the power comes at a cost. And the cost is, well, for example, it scares away beginner developers that come into the project and they, oh, I have to enable this weird pragma of GHC to have this and that so that this paper from 2 years ago can actually be used in our code base and so on. And you don't want that. Another common problem with the solutions to this problem is error messages. Okay, if you try to make everything more extensible, error messages are going to get worse. And often it's worth it to use a less flexible approach that is more constrained and that generates better error messages. Because the error messages, they are here to stay. You will see a lot of them in the rest of your life with this program, and all the newcomers will see a lot of them as well, so you want them to be nice. Okay, so it's an interesting problem, but it's not the point of this talk. And a last point that I think is, not very well known, less known than the extensibility problem, is, okay, when you evolve your code by adding at the bottom or in a new file, you end up with logic that is spread sort of all over the code base. But sometimes what you want is locality, okay? So, one way to phrase this is, why do people say that functional languages are nicer at building compilers. Okay, I just said that the two are the same, modulo some mirror style symmetry. So why do we say that? And I think that an easy, I mean, a natural answer to this question is say when you define a compiler, so it doesn't need to be some Hybro LLVM stuff. It could be just you have a tiny DSL, you want to translate it into JavaScript by appending strings together. Okay, that's a compiler. You probably want to see the code of all the instructions in the DSL. The logic that produces the target, the low-level code, in the same place, right? Because if you have, let's say, I don't know, you have a call and a return instruction in your DSL instructions, the way they are going to be compiled sort of match each other, okay? One is going to set up some structure and the other is going to collect it or explore it or use it. And seeing the two close together is nice. On the other hand, if you have a GUI element like a button, if you think of the problem decomposition in terms of each case is a different button of my GUI, if you use the functional programming approach, you would have a function like style that say the style of button 1 is that, and the style of button 2 is this style, and the style of button 3 is this other style. And this is not what you want. What you want is to say, okay, button 1, show me the style, the callbacks, the interface rules, whatever, all in the same place. So in this case, you want to see all the operations on button 1 at the same place, locally. So, and this is one reason why people say functional programming is better for writing compilers, which is that typically for a compiler, you want a local view of all the cases, where for a GUI, you want a local view of all the operations. In a sense. So this sounds like an IDE feature, okay, if you think about it that way. I want to write code in any of the two styles and then click a button that says flip, and then you see the other approach. So that if you write code in one style and actually you find out you want the local view of the other style, you can do it. But it's more than an IDE feature because then you end up with many complex questions like, okay, I see the flip view, can I edit the flip view? And then do the edits that I do on the flip view, are they reflected back into the original program? What happens? Can I check when I do these kind of changes that I haven't defined a case for which an operation is missing? So in fact, if you think about it in details, it's sort of just as hard as the extensibility problem, but formulated as a IDE feature question. Okay, so there is no free lunch. It's not just enough to click the flip button, but it's interesting to think of it that way. In the rest of my time, actually I have two more sections, but I'm probably only going to have time to do this one. I'm going to talk about, okay, when you have a program that is written in one of these two sides, oh, sorry, do you have questions? No more questions? You should come up with questions. Okay. I'm going to talk about if you have your program that is mostly in one of these two styles. So I'm not talking about languages here, I'm talking about programming style, okay? Can you locally use the other style when it makes sense? How do you do that? Mm. And the good news is that most of the time you can, and it's a good idea to do so. So let's say you are in a functional programming language, and in some place you use the OO style organization of your code. The good news is that all functional programming languages provide good support for products, tuples, structs, records, these things, okay? The thing that we said describe object in my sort of abstract model of the design. So here is, for example, an OCaml declaration for a record type or structure that is what I call an open tree. I don't know what's in the tree, I only know how to count it and how to count the leaves and to get the node height for this tree. And actually, you can define a node case on this representation, just as in the OO style presentation that I was showing. Okay, if you don't have objects but you have records, you're good to go on that one. And actually, it sounds a bit academic, but people use it, especially in a pattern where you have a type. So here the idea is, okay, I have a representation of trees and I'm going to do everything on this representation. This is not usually what you want to do, because the other one, the representation as a subtype, is nicer for most purposes. But what you can do is to say, so maybe I will have a closed list of cases that I know, leaf and node, and then I will have, at the last case, will be open. And then put anything you want here that knows how to count itself, count the leaves, and measure its own node height. So some situation where people use this pattern is they want to have a plugin system where users will provide their own kind of trees, inject them into the system. So then you can try to do something like that way. If you know that something is a leaf or a node, you get nice code. And if you don't know, you get this. The downside of this pattern, which is interesting, is that this data type has written in stone the list of closed cases here and the list of operations. So if you want to add either a case or an operation, you need to update that. And in some cases, it's not a problem, but it adds more coupling. So unless you do have a plugin system, maybe you don't really want to go that way. It makes things a bit more complex. Maybe you could do without a plugin system. You just develop open source code and you provide your stuff as a library, and people don't have to use plugins. They can just use your library, and that this problem sort of goes away. But this pattern, the sort of open case, occurs from time to time. In the other case, you are in an OO language and you want to use the functional programming style locally. Well, if you are lucky, you are in an object-oriented language that does have good support for some types, you know, disjoint list of cases. So here is an example in Scala. I have a seal trait tree with two case classes, which are the cases that I was talking about, leaf and node. And so what this means, so the case keyword guarantees that you get the nice pattern matching syntax that I've been using also in Scala. And the sealed keyword is pretty important. It tells the compiler that this is the only place in the whole program where tree is extended with new cases. And so it lets the compiler know that there is no other case that can occur for tree. And so the compiler can check that the definition of the operations is exhaustive, that you handle all the cases. Otherwise, if you don't say that it's sealed, some other things could be added later. So it cannot really check that all the possible cases are handled by each operation. So it matters in practice. This sealing is very important for ergonomy. So if you write Scala code or any other language that has support for some types or variants or whatever, disjoint unions, you're good. But unfortunately, sometimes is an idea that seems a bit too weird to some language designers, and they don't support it. So what do you do? And the answer, I apologize for that, but it's not my fault, but the answer is not so nice. So what you do is the visitor pattern, but why do you do the visitor pattern? Well, the point is you cannot have cases nicely defined, so the thing you can have are methods. So how can we turn cases into methods? And here is a sort of reconstruction of what happens. So say you have a data type A, you can say, well, to be a consumer of A, someone that I'm an operation that consumes A, and I produce a result of type R. So this is informal, semi-abstract math stuff. Okay, so an A consumer that produces an R as a result is just a function from A to R. A B consumer, thank you, is a function from B to R. And so from that you can define someone that knows how to consume an A or B. So what is an A or B consumer? You can say, well, if I know how to consume an A and I know how to consume a B, I produce the same type R, I am an A or B consumer. If you remember my sort of reasoning rule on sums before, it's the same idea. And so you can define an A or B, so something of type A or B is the same as an object that for any R can turn a consumer of A or B that produces an R into an R. Okay? So if someone wants to consume an A or B to produce an R, if for any such person I can give you an R, I am an A or B. Okay. And in fact, so here's the idea. Let's define the type A plus B, A or B, that we do not have in our language, poor us, by this sort of polymorphic product of two functions returning, it's not a polymorphic product, it's a polymorphic function that takes a product as parameter and returns an R. So what does this look like in code? Well, you can do it on your own. So here is a tree consumer, it's a fault, so it takes an A tree and it produces an R So it has an onLeaf method. So if the input is a leaf, you get the A, the payload of the leaf, and you produce an R. If it's you are on the load on the node, you get the result for the left tree and the right subtree, and you produce the result for the whole tree. And so you can define the class tree-like, which is has a single method, which I call visit, that for any R takes an R AR fold or consumer and produces an R. And you can see that it's sort of like a tree because you can define the count function sort of like by pattern matching. So you take a tree-like, you call the visit method, visit expects an object of type tree fold here, and I'm saying, okay, to count, well, if you are called on a leaf, if the visitor is called on a leaf, you return one. If it's called on a node with the count on the left and the count on the right, you do the sum. So, and this looks sort of like, I mean, this looks like pattern matching, only except weirder. So it feels more complex than normal sums because it is. Okay, and one lesson is that sum types matter a lot. We see them a lot in everyday domain modeling, despite the fact that people that were raised on C programming do not necessarily see them as easily, but in fact they exist and they are pretty easy to see. So if you have them in the language, your life is better. And if you don't, your life sometimes looks like that. Sorry about that. Actually, you could ask, okay, so you did a very complex trick to sort of encode sums in a language that doesn't have sums. Could you do some sort of very complex trick to encode products in a language that doesn't have products? I said that all languages have products. People only have a problem with sums for some reason. But yes, we can. Okay, if you think of a version of your favorite functional language that does not have products, you can define, a consumer of A and B as a function that takes an A and a B and returns an R. Okay, and then you can define the pair of A and B as something that takes a consumer at this type and just feed the two inputs to the consumer. And so you can define the first projection of a pair by saying, okay, get the pair, pass it to a consumer that will take the two components and just returns the first one. And you can check that this behaves as you would expect. And then someone could ask, well, you sort of cheated because you are using curried functions here, which are sort of like a product. Could you do the sum, the same thing with a sum instead? And yes, we can. You can say that the consumer of AB to R is either an A to R or a B to R, and you can do the same kind of stuff. So if you can make your program as complex as you want, if you want to, yay, functional program. But in fact, you don't need to do that because you have products in your system. And then I will use the remaining of my time to talk about some of the difference between the two. So we briefly mentioned, we did not mention subtyping, but there are other things. So I sort of cheated when I said that records and objects are the same for this organization of the code, because when you are in a real object-oriented language, method calls are late bound. Okay, so if you are actually on a subclass, calling a method may do something more precise and more interesting than what you would expect by sort of trying to statically resolve the method calls. And so here is an example. Here I'm using a tree, but then am I also defining a sort of visitor structure for the tree as an object? And you would say, well, why are you doing that when you say that if you have sums in your language, you don't need to? Well, sometimes this sort of late binding is useful. So here I can define a tree mapper. So a tree mapper takes a function f from A to B, and then it returns a visitor that takes an A tree and returns a B tree by mapping over the tree and applying the function on all the leaves. And if you have a tree mapper, you can use inheritance, which sometimes is useful, as a way to define a more precise mapper that is like the tree mapper, okay? Except that on every leaf, it's going to print some logging message. I'm on the leaf blah. And the point about this example is that I'm inheriting the tree mapper, I'm overloading the onLeaf method, but I'm not saying anything about what to do on the node, because this is defined in the tree mapper object. And this is nice, okay? I get to take a traversal function and extend it a bit by only mentioning the part that changed, and this is something that you get thanks to object-oriented programming, late binding. You can do the same thing with a functional program, this is open recursion, but I'm starting to get a bit out of time. So open recursion is sort of the same. It's cool. You should learn about it. Sometimes it's a useful pattern. And let me go to the last sort of point I wanted to get through in this section, which is that, yes, the visitor pattern gives a form of pattern matching. Okay, this is what I had before. And the good news is that you also have exhaustivity checking. Okay, if you forget to define the method for the leaf or for the node, it's checked by the signature of the object, so you get a warning. But the bad news is that pattern matching is not just checking the very topmost constructor of your structure and saying it's a leaf or a node. It's about being able to do things that are more flexible than that. So for example, you can match in depth. Okay, I define a rebalance function that is like, I want my tree, for some reason, I want the left subtree to never be a complex node. It should only be a leaf. So I want to shuffle around the node of the tree to get this property. So the rebalance function say, well, if I get a leaf, I return this leaf, it's fine, it's rebalanced in the way I expect. If I get a node and the left element is a leaf, I return the tree, very nice. And if I get a node and then, oh, there is a node on the left, let's call the subchild of this node the left-left and left-right child, and then I also have a right subtree. Then I'm going to move this around, so I'm going to build a tree whose left children is the left-left one, and on the right I have the left-right and the right, so the order of traversal is preserved, but I moved some nodes on the right. And because the left-left may still be a node, I'm going to call rebalance again to keep shuffling things around as long as I don't have a leaf on the left, okay? So, pretty useless function, but pretty nice code for the useless function. And if you try to do the same with a visitor pattern, you're kind of doomed, okay? So the point is, okay, they are symmetric, but there are small differences, and it's still the case that some types are better at some things, and object-oriented programming, because it gives you other things like late binding or inheritance, is also occasionally convenient, and it's a good reason to use it. So I will stop here. So the lessons would be, okay, typically we favor one style when writing a program. It's good to think about which style you are using and whether it matches what you need in terms of locality or extensibility. And if you recognize the need for the other style for a sub part of your program, you can do it. Okay, and if you are in a functional language, I would say in a functional first language, or if you are in a nice enough object-oriented language, it's easy to do it. Otherwise, you will have to hack around a bit, and your colleagues might not like that. And if you are a language designer, or if you know a language designer, someone who is not a language designer but is still designing languages, please implement good support for sums or variant types. I mean, these things are everywhere, and they are just so much nicer than the weird encodings you would do otherwise. Okay, either a foo or a bar, very common. So have first-class support for that. Thank you.
We have time for questions.
So we talk about programming style. What about maybe like parity and its ties to functional programming or not?
I would say that it is orthogonal to this talk.
Yeah.
But I would point out that most of the languages we use in practice are impure. So maybe one exception would be Idris. But one language that people like to call pure, which is a very nice language, is Haskell, is also impure in loops, and it has exceptions all over the place. And both these things are also horrible. So unfortunately, it's very hard to escape the impurity. I don't think it factors into the decision of one representation of the other. In general, you should try to be as pure as you can in both styles, I would say. So you had a question?
Yeah, what do you think of multi-methods?
I like multi-methods. I think, like I mentioned Joomla briefly, it's good for some interesting reasons, it's good for performance in Julia. So in a sense, there are no multi-methods in my talk because I define operations in a very simplified way on just one input. And then it's which case are we? But if you have several parameters, which is pretty common, then you might want to define your operations by matching on both cases of both parameters at once. In a functional programming style, it's very easy. You do a match on a tuple, and then you have two cases. In an OO setting, in many cases, you would do that with multi-methods if you have them. So yes, nice. So along one reason why you may say that is object-oriented style makes it easy to have a notion of local states for the objects, and then the state may be immutable. And also people point out that it gives a notion of identity, which is what is often useful when you have mutability. So that's a good question. So in this case, everything was stateless. So there was no question. If you wanted to have state, would you prefer one form or the other? So I think in typical functional programming style, you would represent the state as an explicit part of the system, as a state parameter that is either just an input if your state is read-only, and people would say, oh, it's the reader monad, or is both an input or an output if you read and write the state. And so you also have a relatively natural presentation of stateful program this way. I think it is nice. It works. I wouldn't worry too much about being stuck because there is state in the system. It has to be explicit, but it is good. But there might be some cases where the locality you get through object-oriented, like the fact that the state is very easy to scope and say, well, it's attached to this object, may be convenient. Yes, I'm not completely sure. When I write code in the functional style, I do not mind adding state explicitly, and in practice it goes well. But you do not want to have a type which is the state of all my application, and then you pass just that all over the place. This is bad. So you have to be careful about granularity.
Great. Thanks again.